3. Instant Ubik has all the fresh flavor of Just Brewed Drip Coffee. Your husband will say, "Christ, Sally, I used to think your coffee was only so-so. But now, wow. Safe, when taken as directed." Still in gay, pinstripe, clown-style pajamas, Joe Chip hazily seated himself at his kitchen table, lit a cigarette, and after inserting a dime, twiddled the dial of his recently rented pape machine. Having a hangover, he dialed off Interplan News, hovered momentarily at domestic news, and then selected gossip.
"Yes, sir," the pape machine said heartily. "Gossip. Guess what Stanton Mick, the reclusive, interplanetarily known speculator and financier, is up to at this very moment?"
Its works whizzed, and a scroll of printed matter crept from its slot. The ejected roll, a document in 4 colors, niftily incised with bold type, rolled across the surface of the neo-teakwood table and bounced to the floor. His head aching, Chip retrieved it, spread it out flat before him. Mick hits World Bank for 2 trill, AP, London. What could Stanton Mick, the reclusive, interplanetarily known speculator and financier, be up to, the business community asked itself, as rumor leaked out of Whitehall that the dashing but peculiar industrial magnate, who once offered to build, free of charge, a fleet by which Israel could colonize and make fertile, otherwise desert areas of Mars, had asked for and may possibly receive a staggering and unprecedented loan of...
"This isn't gossip," Joe Chip said to the pape machine. "This is speculation about fiscal transactions. Today I want to read about which TV star is sleeping with whose drug-addicted wife."
He had, as usual, not slept well, at least in terms of REM, rapid eye movement sleep. And he had resisted taking a soporific because, very unfortunately, his weak supply of stimulants, provided him by the autonomic pharmacy of his CONAP building, had run out, due admittedly to his own oral greed, but nonetheless gone. By law, he could not approach the pharmacy for more until next Tuesday. 2 days away. 2 long days. The pape machine said,
"Set the dial for low gossip."
He did so, and a second scroll, excreted by the pape machine without delay, emerged. He zoomed in on an excellent caricature drawing of Lola Herzberg Wright, licked his lips with satisfaction at the naughty exposure of her entire right ear, then feasted on the text. Accosted by a cut purse in a fancy New York after-hours mole the other night, Lola Herzberg Wright bounced a swift right jab off the chops of the do-batter, which sent him reeling onto the table, where King Egon Groat of Sweden and an unidentified miss with astonishingly large... The ring construct of his CONAP door jangled. Startled, Joe Chip glanced up, found his cigarette attempting to burn the formica surface of his neo-teakwood table. Coped with that, then shuffled blearily to the speak tube mounted handily by the release bolt of the door.
"Who is it?"
he grumbled, checking with his wristwatch. He saw that 8 o'clock had not arrived. Probably the rent robot, he decided, or a creditor. He did not trigger off the release bolt of the door. An enthusiastic male voice from the door's speaker exclaimed,
"I know it's early, Joe, but I just hit town. Gigi Ashwood here. I've got a firm prospect that I snared in Topeka. I read this one is magnificent, and I want your confirmation before I lay the pitch in Runciter's lap. Anyhow, he's in Switzerland."
Chip said,
"I don't have my test equipment in the app."
"I'll shoot over to the shop and pick it up for you."
"It's not at the shop."
Reluctantly, he admitted,
"It's in my car. I didn't get around unloading it last night."
In actuality, he had been too pizzled on Papapot to get the trunk of his hover car open.
"Can it wait until after 9?
He asked irritably. Gigi Ashwood's unstable manic energy annoyed him even at noon. This, at 7:40, struck him as downright impossible, worse even than a creditor.
Chip, dearie, this is a sweet number. A walking symposium of miracles that'll curl the needles of your gauges. And, in addition, give new life to the firm, which it badly needs. And furthermore,
it's an anti-what? Joe Chip asked. Telepath?
I'll lay it on you right out in front,
G.G. Ashwood declared.
I don't know. Listen, Chip.
Ashwood lowered his voice.
This is confidential, this particular one. I can't stand down here at the gate, gum flapping away out loud. Somebody might overhear. In fact, I'm already picking up the thoughts of some glunk in a ground-level apt. Okay,
Joe Chip said, resigned. Once started, G.G. Ashwood's relentless monologues couldn't be aborted anyhow. He might as well listen to it.
Give me 5 minutes to get dressed and find out if I've got any coffee left in the apt anywhere.
He had a quasi-memory of shopping last night at the ConApp supermarket. In particular, a memory of tearing out a green ration stamp, which could mean either coffee or tea or cigarettes or fancy imported snuff.
You'll like her,
G.G. Ashwood stated energetically.
Although, as often happens, she's the daughter of a...
her? In alarm, Joe Chip said, my app's unfit to be seen. I'm behind on my payments to the building cleanup robots. They haven't been inside here in 2 weeks.
I'll ask her if she cares.
Don't ask her. I care. I'll test her out down at the shop, on Runciter's time.
I read her mind, and she doesn't care.
How old is she? Maybe, he thought, she's only a child. Quite a few new and potential inertials were children, having developed their ability in order to protect themselves against their psionic parents.
How old are you, dear?
G.G. Ashwood asked faintly, turning his head away to speak to the person with him.
19,
he reported to Joe Chip. Well, that shot that. But now he had become curious. G.G. Ashwood's razzle-dazzle, wound-up tightness usually manifested itself in conjunction with attractive women. Maybe this girl fell into that category.
Give me 15 minutes,
he told G.G. If he worked fast and skulked about in a cleanup campaign, and if he missed both coffee and breakfast, he could probably effect a tidy apt by then. At least it seemed worth trying. He rang off, then searched in the cupboards of the kitchen for a broom, manual or self-powered, or vacuum cleaner, helium battery, or wall socket. Neither could be found. Evidently, he'd never been issued any sort of cleaning equipment by the building's supply agency. Hell of a time, he thought, to find that out. And he had lived here 4 years. Picking up the vidphone, he dialed 214, the extension for the maintenance circuit of the building.
Listen, he said when the homeostatic entity answered. I'm now in a position to divert some of my funds in the direction of settling my bill vis-a-vis your cleanup robots. I'd like them up here right now to go over my apt. I'll pay the full and entire bill when they're finished.
Sir, you'll pay your full and entire bill before they start.
By now he had his billfold in hand. From it he dumped his supply of magic credit keys, most of which by now had been voided. Probably in perpetuity, his relationship with money and the payment of pressing debts being such as it was.
I'll charge my overdue bill against my triangular magic key,
he informed his nebulous antagonist.
That'll transfer the obligation out of your jurisdiction. On your books, it'll show as total restitution.
Plus fines, plus penalties.
I'll charge those against my heart-shaped...
Mr. Chip, the Ferris and Brockman Retail Credit Auditing and Analysis Agency has published a special flyer on you. Our recept slot received it yesterday, and it remains fresh in our minds. Since July, you've dropped from a triple G status credit-wise to quadruple G. Our department, in fact, this entire ConApp building, is now programmed against an extension of services and or credit to such pathetic anomalies as yourself, sir. Regarding you, everything must hereafter be handled on a basic cash subfloor. In fact, you'll probably be on a basic cash subfloor for the rest of your life. In fact,
he hung up. and abandoned the hope of enticing and/or threatening the cleanup robots into entering his muddled apt. Instead, he padded into the bedroom to dress. He could do that without assistance. After he had dressed in a sporty maroon wrapper, twinkle toes, turned-up shoes, and a felt cap with a tassel, he poked about hopefully in the kitchen for some manifestation of coffee. None. He then focused on the living room and found, by the door leading to the bathroom, last night's great cape, every spotty blue yard of it, and a plastic bag which contained a half-pound can of authentic Kenya coffee. A great treat, and one which only while pizzled would he have risen to, especially in view of his current abominable financial situation. Back in the kitchen, he fished in his various pockets for a dime, and with it started up the coffee pot. Sniffing the, to him, very unusual smell, he again consulted his watch, saw that 15 minutes had passed. He therefore vigorously strode to the app door, turned the knob, and pulled on the release bolt. The door refused to open. It said, 5 cents, please. He searched his pockets. No more coins. Nothing.
I'll pay you tomorrow, he told the door.
Again, he tried the knob. Again, it remained locked tight.
What I pay you, he informed it, is in the nature of a gratuity. I don't have to pay you.
I think otherwise, the door said. Look in the purchase contract you signed when you bought this Conapt.
In his desk drawer, he found the contract. Since signing it, he had found it necessary to refer to the document many times. Sure enough, payment to his door for opening and shutting constituted a mandatory fee, not a tip.
You discover I'm right, the door said. It sounded smug.
From the drawer beside the sink, Joe Chip got a stainless steel knife. With it, he began systematically to unscrew the bolt assembly of his app's money-gulping door.
I'll sue you,
the door said as the first screw fell out. Joe Chip said,
I've never been sued by a door, but I guess I can live through it.
A knock sounded on the door.
Hey, Joe, baby, it's me, Gigi Ashwood! And I've got her right here with me. Open up.
Put a nickel in the slot for me, Joe said. The mechanism seems to be jammed on my side.
A coin rattled down into the works of the door. It swung open, and there stood G.G. Ashwood with a brilliant look on his face. It pulsed with sly intensity, an erratic, gleaming triumph as he propelled the girl forward and into the apt. She stood for a moment, staring at Joe, obviously no more than 17, slim and copper-skinned, with large, dark eyes.
My God, he thought. She's beautiful.
She wore an ersatz canvas work shirt and jeans, heavy boots caked with what appeared to be authentic mud. Her tangle of shiny hair was tied back and knotted with a red bandana. Her rolled-up sleeve showed tanned, competent arms. At her imitation leather belt, she carried a knife, a field telephone unit, and an emergency pack of rations and water. On her bare, dark forearm, he made out a tattoo. Caveat emptor, it read. He wondered what that meant.
This is Pat,
G.G. Ashwood said, his arm with ostentatious familiarity around the girl's waist.
Never mind her last name.
Square and puffy, like an overweight brick, wearing his usual mohair poncho, apricot-colored felt hat, argyle ski socks, and carpet slippers, he advanced toward Joe Chip, self-satisfaction smirking from every molecule in his body. He had found something of value here, and he meant to make the most of it.
Pat, this is the company's highly skilled first-line electrical type tester.
Coolly, the girl said to Joe Chip,
Is it you that's electrical, or your tests?
We trade off, Joe said. He felt from all around him the miasma of his uncleaned up apt. It radiated the specter of debris and clutter, and he knew that Pat had already noticed.
Sit down, he said awkwardly. Have a cup of actual coffee.
Such luxury,
Pat said, seating herself at the kitchen table. Reflexively, she gathered the week's heap of papes into a neater pile.
How can you afford real coffee, Mr. Chip?
Gigi Ashwood said,
Joe gets paid a hell of a lot. The firm couldn't operate without him.
Reaching out, he took a cigarette from the package lying on the table.
Put it back, Joe Chip said. I'm almost out, and I used up my last green ration stamp on the coffee.
I paid for the door,
Gigi pointed out. He offered the pack to the girl.
Joe puts on an act. Pay no attention. Like, look how he keeps his place. Shows he's creative. All geniuses live like this. Where's your test equipment, Joe? We're wasting time.
To the girl, Joe said, You're dressed oddly.
I maintain the subsurface vidphone lines at the Topeka Kibbutz,
Pat said.
Only women can hold jobs involving manual labor at that particular kibbutz. That's why I applied there, instead of the Wichita Falls kibbutz.
Her black eyes blazed pridefully. Joe said,
That inscription on your arm, that tattoo, is that Hebrew?
Latin.
Her eyes veiled her amusement.
I've never seen an app so cluttered with rubbish. Don't you have a mistress?
These electrical expert types have no time for tarradiddle,
Gigi Ashwood said irritably.
Listen, Chip, this girl's parents work for Ray Hollis. If they knew she was here, they'd give her a frontal lobotomy.
To the girl, Joe Chip said,
They don't know you have a counter talent?
No.
She shook her head.
I didn't really understand it either until your scout sat down with me in the kibbutz cafeteria and told me. Maybe it's true.
She shrugged.
Maybe not. He said you could show me objective proof of it with your testing battery.
How would you feel, he asked her, if the tests show that you have it?
Reflecting, Pat said,
It seems so negative. I don't do anything. I don't move objects or turn stones into bread or give birth without impregnation or reverse the illness process in sick people or read minds or look into the future. Not even common talents like that. I just negate somebody else's ability. It seems...
She gestured.
Stultifying.
As a survival factor for the human race, Joe said, it's as useful as the psi talents, especially for us norms. The anti-psi factor is a natural restoration of ecological balance. One insect learns to fly, so another learns to build a web to trap him. Is that the same as no flight? Clams developed hard shells to protect them. Therefore, birds learn to fly the clam up high in the air and drop him on a rock. In a sense, you're a life form preying on the size, and the size are life forms that prey on the norms. That makes you a friend of the norm class. Balance, a full circle, predator and prey. It appears to be an eternal system, and frankly, I can't see how it could be improved.
I might be considered a traitor,
Pat said.
Does it bother you?
It bothers me that people will feel hostile toward me. But I guess you can't live very long without arousing hostility. You can't please everybody, because people want different things. Please one, and you displease another.
Joe said, What is your anti-talent?
It's hard to explain.
Like I say, Gigi Ashwood said, It's unique. I've never heard of it before.
Which psi talent does it counteract? Joe asked the girl.
Precog?
Pat said.
I guess.
She indicated Gigi Ashwood, whose smirk of enthusiasm had not dimmed.
Your scout, Mr. Ashwood, explained it to me. I knew I did something funny. I've always had these strange periods in my life, starting my sixth year. I never told my parents because I sensed that it would displease them.
Are they precogs? Joe asked.
Yes.
You're right. It would have displeased them. But if you used it around them, even once, they would have known. Didn't they suspect? Didn't you interfere with their ability?
Pat said.
She
gestured.
I think I did interfere, but they didn't know it.
Her face showed bewilderment.
Let me explain, Joe said, how the anti-precog generally functions. Functions, in fact, in every case we know of. The precog sees a variety of futures, laid out side by side like cells in a beehive. For him, one has greater luminosity, and this he picks.
Once he's picked it, the anti-precog can do nothing. The anti-precog has to be present when the precog is in the process of deciding, not after. The anti-precog makes all futures seem equally real to the precog. He aborts his talent to choose at all. A precog is instantly aware when an anti-precog is nearby because his entire relation to the future is altered. In the case of telepaths, a similar impairment.
She goes back in time,
G.G. Ashwood said. Joe stared at him.
Back in time,
G.G. repeated, savoring this. His eyes shot shafts of significance to every part of Joe Chip's kitchen.
The precog affected by her still sees one predominant future. Like you said, the one luminous possibility. And he chooses it, and he's right. But why is it right? Why is it luminous? Because this girl,
he shrugged in her direction,
Pat, controls the future. That one luminous possibility is luminous because she's gone into the past and changed it. By changing it, she changes the present, which includes the precog. He's affected without knowing it, and his talent seems to work, whereas it really doesn't. So that's one advantage of her anti-talent over other anti-precog talents. The other, and greater, is that she can cancel out the precog's decision after he's made it. She can enter the situation later on, and this problem has always hung us up, as you know. If we didn't get in there from the start, we couldn't do anything. In a way, we never could truly abort the precog ability as we've done with the others, right? Hasn't that been a weak link in our services?
He eyed Joe Chip expectantly.
Interesting,
Joe said presently.
Hell, interesting!
G.G. Ashwood thrashed about indignantly.
This is the greatest anti-talent to emerge thus far!
In a low voice, Pat said,
I don't go back in time.
She raised her eyes, confronted Joe Chip half apologetically, half belligerently.
I do something, but Mr. Ashwood has built it up all out of proportion to reality.
I can read your mind,
G.G. said to her, looking a little nettled.
I know you can change the past. You've done it.
Pat said,
I can change the past, but I don't go into the past. I don't time travel, as you want your tester to think.
How do you change the past? Joe asked her.
I think about it. One specific aspect of it, such as one incident, or something somebody said, or a little thing that happened that I wish hadn't happened. The first time I did this, as a child.
When she was 6 years old?
G.G. broke in.
Living in Detroit, with her parents, of course, she broke a ceramic antique statue that her father treasured.
Didn't your father foresee it? Joe asked her, with his precog ability?
He foresaw it, Pat answered, and he punished me the week before I broke the statue. But he said it was inevitable. You know the precog talent. They can foresee, but they can't change anything. And after the statue did break, after I broke it, I should say, I brooded about it, and I thought about that week before it broke, when I didn't get any dessert at dinner and had to go to bed at 5 p.m. I thought, Christ, or whatever a kid says, isn't there some way these unfortunate events can be averted? My father's precog ability didn't seem very spectacular to me since he couldn't alter events. I still feel that way, a sort of contempt. I spent a month trying to will the damn statue back into one piece. In my mind, I kept going back to before I broke it, imagining what it had looked like, which was awful. And then, one morning when I got up, I even dreamed about it at night. There it stood, as it used to be.
Tensely, she leaned toward Joe Chip. She spoke in a sharp, determined voice.
But neither of my parents noticed anything. It seemed perfectly normal to them that the statue was in one piece. They thought it had always been in one piece. I was the only one who remembered.
She smiled, leaned back, took another of his cigarettes from the pack, and lit up.
I'll go get my test equipment from the car,
Joe said, starting toward the door.
5 cents, please,
the door said as he seized its knob.
Pay the door,
Joe said to G.G. Ashwood. When he had lugged his armload of testing apparatus from the car to his apt, he told the firm's scout to hit the road.
What?
Gigi said, astounded.
But I found her! The bounty's mine! I spent almost 10 days tracing the field to her!
Joe said to him,
I can't test her with your field present. As you well know, talent and anti-talent fields deform each other. If they didn't, we wouldn't be in this line of business.
He held out his hand as Gigi got grumpily to his feet.
And leave me a couple of nickels, so she and I can get out of here.
I have change, Pat murmured, in my purse.
You can measure the force she creates, Gigi said, by the loss within my field. I've seen you do it that way 100 times.
Joe said, briefly,
this is different.
I don't have any more nickels, Gigi said. I can't get out.
Glancing at Joe, then at Gigi, Pat said,
have one of mine.
She tossed Gigi a coin, which he caught, an expression of bewilderment on his face. The bewilderment, then, by degrees, changed to a grieved sullenness.
You sure shot me down,
he said as he deposited the nickel in the door's slot.
Both of you,
he muttered as the door closed after him.
I discovered her. This is really a cutthroat business when...
His voice faded out as the door clamped shut. There was, then, silence. Presently, Pat said,
when his enthusiasm goes, there isn't much left of him.
He's okay,
Joe said. He felt a usual feeling, guilt, but not very much.
Anyhow, he did his part. Now...
Now it's your turn,
Pat said,
so to speak. May I take off my boots?
Sure,
he said. He began to set up his test equipment, checking the drums, the power supply. He started trial motions of each needle, releasing specific surges and recording their effect.
A shower?
She asked as she set her boots neatly out of the way.
A quarter,
he murmured.
It costs a quarter.
He glanced up at her and saw that she had begun unbuttoning her blouse.
I don't have a quarter, he said.
At the kibbutz, Pat said. Everything is free.
Free?
He stared at her.
That's not economically feasible. How can it operate on that basis for more than a month?
She continued, unperturbedly unbuttoning her blouse.
Our salaries are paid in and we're credited with having done our job. The aggregate of our earnings underwrites the kibbutz as a whole. Actually, the Topeka kibbutz has shown a profit for several years. We, as a group, are putting in more than we're taking out.
Having unbuttoned her blouse, she laid it over the back of her chair. Under the blue, coarse blouse, she wore nothing, and he perceived her breasts, hard and high, held well by the accurate muscles of her shoulders.
Are you sure you want to do that?
He said.
To take off your clothes, I mean?
Pat said.
You don't remember.
Remember what?
My not taking off my clothes. In another present, you didn't like that very well, so I eradicated that, hence this.
She stood up lithely.
What did I do?
He asked cautiously.
When you didn't take off your clothes, refused to test you?
You mumbled something about Mr. Ashwood having overrated my anti-talent.
Joe said,
I don't work that way. I don't do that.
Here.
Bending, her breasts wagging forward, she rummaged in the pocket of her blouse, brought forth a folded sheet of paper which she handed him.
From the previous present, the one I abolished.
He read it, read his one-line evaluation at the end.
Anti-psi field generated inadequate. Below standard throughout, no value against precog ratings now in existence.
And then the code mark which he employed, a circle with a stroke dividing it. Do not hire, the symbol meant. And only he and Glenn Runciter knew that. Not even their scouts knew the meaning of the symbol, so Ashwood could not have told her. Silently, he returned the paper to her. She refolded it and returned it to her blouse pocket.
Do you need to test me?
She asked.
After seeing that?
I have a regular procedure, Joe said. 6 indices which...
Pat said,
you're a little debt-stricken, ineffective bureaucrat who can't even scrape together enough coins to pay his door to let him out of his apt.
Her tone, neutral but devastating, rebounded in his ears. He felt himself stiffen, wince, and violently flush.
This is a bad spot right now, he said. I'll be back on my feet financially any day now. I can get a loan from the firm if necessary.
He rose unsteadily, got two cups and two saucers, poured coffee from the coffee pot.
Sugar,
he said. Cream?
Cream,
Pat said, still standing barefoot without her blouse. He fumbled for the door handle of the refrigerator to get out a carton of milk.
10 cents, please,
the refrigerator said.
5 cents for opening my door. 5 cents for the cream.
It isn't cream, he said. It's plain milk.
He continued to pluck, futilely, at the refrigerator door.
Just this one time, he said to it. I swear to God I'll pay you back. Tonight.
Here,
Pat said. She slid a dime across the table toward him.
She should have money,
she said as she watched him put the dime in the slot of the refrigerator.
Your mistress. You really have failed, haven't you? I knew it when Mr. Ashwood—
It isn't, he grated. Always like this.
Do you want me to bail you out of your problems, Mr. Chip?
Hands in the pockets of her jeans, she regarded him expressionlessly, no emotion clouding her face, only alertness.
You know I can. Sit down and write out your evaluation report on me. Forget the tests. My talent is unique anyway. You can't measure the field I produce. It's in the past, and you're testing me in the present, which simply takes place as an automatic consequence. Do you agree?
He said, let me see that evaluation sheet you have in your blouse. I want to look at it one more time, before I decide. From her blouse, she once more brought forth the folded up yellow sheet of paper. She calmly passed it across the table to him, and he reread it.
My writing, he said to himself. Yes. It's true.
He returned it to her, and from the collection of testing items took a fresh, clean sheet of the same familiar yellow paper. On it he wrote her name, then spurious, extraordinarily high test results, and then at last his conclusions, his new conclusions.
Has unbelievable power, anti-psi field unique in scope, can probably negate any assembly of precogs imaginable.
After that he scratched a symbol. This time, two crosses, both underlined. Pat, standing behind him, watched him write. He felt her breath on his neck.
What do the two underlined crosses mean?
She asked.
Hire her, Joe said, at whatever cost required.
Thank you.
She dug into her purse, brought out a handful of POSCRED bills, selected one, and presented it to him. A big one.
This will help you with expenses. I couldn't give it to you earlier, before you made your official evaluation of me. You would have canceled very nearly everything, and you would have gone to your grave thinking I had bribed you. Ultimately, you would have even decided that I had no counter-talent.
She then unzipped her jeans and resumed her quick, furtive undressing. Joe Chip examined what he had written, not watching her. The underlined crosses did not symbolize what he had told her. They meant, watch this person. She is a hazard to the firm. She is dangerous. He signed the test paper, folded it, and passed it to her. She at once put it away in her purse.
When can I move my things in here?
She asked as she padded toward the bathroom.
I consider it mine as of now, since I've already paid you what must be virtually the entire month's rent.
Anytime, he said.
The bathroom said,
50 cents, please, before turning on the water.
Pat padded back into the kitchen to reach into her purse. 4.
Wild new Ubix salad dressing. Not Italian, not French, but an entirely new and different taste treat that's waking up the world. Wake up to Ubix and be wild.
Safe when taken as directed.
Back in New York once more, his trip to the beloved Brethren Moratorium completed, Glenn Runciter landed via a silent and impressive all-electric hired limousine on the roof of the central installation of Runciter Associates. A descent chute dropped him speedily to his fifth-floor office. Presently, at 9:30 a.m. local time, he sat in the massive, old-fashioned, authentic walnut and leather swivel chair behind his desk, talking on the vidphone to his public relations department.
Tamish, I just now got back from Zurich. I conferred with Ella there.
Runciter glared at his secretary, who had cautiously entered his personal, oversized office, shutting the door behind her.
What do you want, Mrs. Frick?
He asked her. Withered, timorous Mrs. Frick, her face dabbed with spots of artificial color to compensate for her general ancient grayness, made a gesture of disavowal. She had no choice but to bother him.
Okay, Mrs. Frick, he said patiently. What is it?
A new client, Mr. Runciter. I think you should see her.
She both advanced toward him and retreated, a difficult maneuver which Mrs. Frick alone could carry off. It had taken her 10 decades of practice.
As soon as I'm off the phone,
Runciter told her. Into the phone, he said,
How often do our ads run on primetime TV planet-wide? Still once every third hour?
Not quite that, Mr. Runciter. Over the course of a full day, Prudence ads appear on an average of once every third hour per UHF channel. But the cost of primetime...
I want them to appear every hour,
Runciter said.
Ella thinks that would be better.
On the trip back to the Western Hemisphere, he had decided which of their ads he liked the most.
Not quite that, Mr. Runciter. Over the course of a full day, Prudence ads appear on an average of once every third hour per UHF channel. But the cost of primetime...
I want them to appear every hour,
Runciter said.
Ella thinks that would be better.
On the trip back to the Western Hemisphere, he had decided which of their ads he liked the most.
You know that recent Supreme Court ruling where a husband can legally murder his wife if he can prove she wouldn't under any circumstances give him a divorce?
Yes, the so-called.
I don't care what it's called. What matters is that we have a TV ad made up on that already. How does that ad go? I've been trying to remember it.
Tamish said, There's this man, an ex-husband, being tried. First comes a shot of the jury, then the judge, then a pan up on the prosecuting attorney, cross-examining the ex-husband. He says, It would seem, sir, that your wife...
That's right,
Runciter said with satisfaction. He had originally helped write the ad. It was, in his opinion, another manifestation of the marvelous multifacetedness of his mind.
Is it not the assumption, however, Tamish said, that the missing sighs are at work, as a group, for one of the larger investment houses. Seeing as how this is probably so, perhaps we should stress one of our business establishment commercials. Do you perhaps recall this one, Mr. Runciter? It shows a husband home from his job at the end of the day. He still has on his electric yellow cummerbund, petal skirt, knee-hugging hose, and military-style visored cap. He seats himself wearily on the living room couch, starts to take off one of his gauntlets, then hunches over, frowns, and says, Gosh, Jill, I wish I knew what's been wrong with me lately. Sometimes, with greater frequency, almost every day, the least little remark at my office makes me think that, well, somebody's reading my mind. Then she says, If you're worried about that, why don't we contact our nearest Prudence organization? They'll lease us an inertial at prices easy on our budget, and then you'll feel like your old self again. Then this great smile appears on his face, and he says, Why, this nagging feeling is already...
Again appearing in the doorway to Runciter's office, Mrs. Frick said,
Please, Mr. Runciter.
Her glasses quivered. He nodded.
I'll talk to you later, Tamish. Anyhow, get hold of the networks and start our material on the hour basis as I outlined.
He rang off, then regarded Mrs. Frick silently.
I went all the way to Switzerland, he said presently, and had Ella roused to get that information, that advice.
Mr. Runciter is free, Miss Wirt.
His secretary tottered to one side, and a plump woman rolled into the office. Her head, like a basketball, bobbled up and down. Her great round body propelled itself toward a chair, and there, at once, she seated herself, narrow legs dangling. She wore an unfashionable spider silk coat, looking like some amiable bug wound up in a cocoon not spun by itself. She looked encased. However, she smiled. She seemed fully at ease. In her late 40s, Runciter decided, past any period in which she might have had a good figure.
"Ah, Miss Wirt," he said. "I can't give you too much time. Maybe you should get to the point. What's the problem?"
In a mellow, merry, incongruous voice, Miss Wirt said,
"We're having a little trouble with telepaths. We think so, but we're not sure. We maintain a telepath of our own, one we know about and who's supposed to circulate among our employees. If he comes across any size, telepaths or precogs, any kind, he's supposed to report to..."
She eyed Runciter brightly.
"To my principal. Late last week he made such a report. We have an evaluation, done by a private firm, on the capacities of the various prudence agencies. Yours is rated foremost."
"I know that," Runciter said.
He had seen the evaluation, as a matter of fact. As yet, however, it had brought him little, if any, greater business. But now this.
"How many telepaths," he said, "did your man pick up? More than one?"
"Two, at least."
"Possibly more?"
"Possibly."
Miss Wirt nodded.
"Here's how we operate," Runciter said. "First, we measure the psi field objectively, so we can tell what we're dealing with. That generally takes from 1 week to 10 days, depending on..."
Miss Wirt interrupted.
"My employer wants you to move in your inertials right away, without the time-consuming and expensive formality of making tests."
"We wouldn't know how many inertials to bring in, or what kind, or where to station them. Diffusing a psi operation has to be done on a systematic basis. We can't wave a magic wand or spray toxic fumes into corners. We have to balance Hollis's people individual by individual, an anti-talent for every talent. If Hollis has gotten into your operation, he's done it the same way, psi by psi. One gets into the personnel department, hires another, that person sets up a department or takes charge of a department and requisitions a couple more. Sometimes it takes them months. We can't undo in 24 hours what they've constructed over a long period of time. Big-time psi activity is like a mosaic. They can't afford to be impatient, and neither can we."
"My employer,"
Miss Wirt said cheerfully,
"is impatient."
"I'll talk to him."
Runciter reached for the vidphone.
"Who is he, and what's his number?"
"You'll deal through me."
"Maybe I won't deal at all. Why won't you tell me who you represent?"
He pressed a covert button mounted under the rim of his desk. It would bring his resident telepath, Nina Freed, into the next office, where she could monitor Miss Wirt's thought processes.
"I can't work with these people," he said to himself, "if I don't know who they are. For all I know, Ray Hollis is trying to hire me."
"You're hidebound,"
Miss Wirt said.
"All we're asking for is speed, and we're only asking for that because we have to have it. I can tell you this much. Our operation, which they've infested, isn't on Earth. From the standpoint of potential yield, as well as from an investment standpoint, it's our primary project. My principal has put all his negotiable assets into it. Nobody's supposed to know about it. The greatest shock to us in finding telepaths on the site..."
"Excuse me,"
Runciter said. He rose, walked to the office door.
"I'll find out how many people we have about the place who are available for use in this connection."
Shutting his office door behind him, he looked into each of the adjoining offices until he spied Nina Freed. She sat alone in a minor side room, smoking a cigarette and concentrating.
"Find out who she represents," he said to her, "and then find out how high they'll go. We've got 38 idle inertials," he reflected. "Maybe we can dump all of them, or most of them, into this. I may finally have found where Hollis's smart-ass talents have sneaked off to. The whole goddamn bunch of them."
He returned to his own office, reseated himself behind his desk.
"If telepaths have gotten into your operation," he said to Miss Wirt, his hands folded before him, "then you have to face up to and accept the realization that the operation, per se, is no longer secret, independent of any specific technical info they've picked up. So why not tell me what the project is?"
Hesitating, Miss Wirt said,
"I don't know what the project is."
"Or where it is?"
"No."
She shook her head.
Runciter said, "Do you know who your employer is?"
"I work for a subsidiary firm which he financially controls. I know who my immediate employer is. That's a Mr. Shepherd Howard. But I've never been told whom Mr. Howard represents."
"If we supply you with the inertials you need, will we know where they're being sent?"
"Probably not."
"Suppose we never get them back?"
"Why wouldn't you get them back? After they've decontaminated our operation."
"Hollis's men," Runciter said, "have been known to kill inertials sent out to negate them. It's my responsibility to see that my people are protected. I can't do that if I don't know where they are."
The concealed microspeaker in his left ear buzzed, and he heard the faint, measured voice of Nina Freed, audible to him alone.
"Miss Wirt represents Stanton Mick. She is his confidential assistant. There is no one named Shepherd Howard. The project under discussion exists primarily on Luna. It has to do with TechPrize, Mick's research facilities, the controlling stock of which Miss Wirt keeps in her name. She does not know any technical details. No scientific evaluations or memos or progress reports are ever made available to her by Mr. Mick, and she resents this enormously. From Mick's staff, however, she has picked up a general idea of the nature of the project. Assuming that her second-hand knowledge is accurate, the Lunar Project involves a radical, new, low-cost interstellar drive system approaching the velocity of light, which could be leased to every moderately affluent political or ethnological group. Mick's idea seems to be that the drive system will make colonization feasible on a mass basic understructure, and hence no longer a monopoly of specific governments."
Nina Freed clicked off, and Runciter leaned back in his leather and walnut swivel chair to ponder.
"What are you thinking?"
Miss Wirt asked brightly.
"I'm wondering," Runciter said, "if you can afford our services. Since I have no test data to go on, I can only estimate how many inertials you'll need. But it may run as high as 40.
He said this knowing that Stanton Mick could afford, or could figure out how to get someone else to underwrite, an unlimited number of inertials.
40,
Miss Wirt echoed.
That is quite a few.
The more we make use of, the sooner we can get the job done. Since you're in a hurry, we'll move them all in at one time. If you're authorized to sign a work contract in the name of your employer..."
He pointed a steady, unyielding finger at her. She did not blink.
"And you can come up with a retainer now. We could probably accomplish this within 72 hours.
He eyed her then, waiting. The microspeaker in his ear rasped,
"As owner of TechPrize, she is fully bonded. She can legally obligate her firm up to and including its total worth. Right now, she's calculating how much this would be if converted on today's market." A pause. "Several billion poscreds, she has decided. But she doesn't want to do this. She doesn't like the idea of committing herself to both a contract and retainer. She would prefer to have Mick's attorneys do that, even if it means several days' delay."
"But they're in a hurry,"
Runciter reflected.
"Or so they say."
The microspeaker said,
She has an intuition that you know or have guessed whom she represents. And she's afraid you'll up your fee accordingly. Mick knows his reputation. He considers himself the world's greatest mark. So he negotiates in this manner, through someone or some firm as a front. On the other hand, they want as many inertials as they can get, and they're resigned to that being enormously expensive.
40 inertials,
Runciter said idly. He scratched with his pen at a small sheet of blank paper on his desk for just such purposes.
Let's see, 6 times 50 times 3 times 40.
Miss Wirt, still smiling her glazed, happy smile, waited with visible tension.
I wonder,
he murmured,
who paid Hollis to put his employees in the middle of your project?
That doesn't really matter, does it?
Miss Wirt said.
What matters is that they're there.
Runciter said,
sometimes one never finds out. But, as you say, it's the same as when ants find their way into your kitchen. You don't ask why they're there, you just begin the job of getting them back out.
He had arrived at a cost figure. It was enormous.
I'll have to think it over,
Miss Wirt said. She raised her eyes from the shocking sight of his estimate and half rose to her feet.
Is there somewhere, an office, where I can be alone and possibly phone Mr. Howard?
Runciter, also rising, said,
it's rare for any prudence organization to have that many inertials available at one time. If you wait, the situation will change. So if you want them, you'd better act.
And you think it would really take that many inertials?
Taking Miss Wirt by the arm, he led her from his office and down the hall, to the firm's map room.
This shows, he told her, the location of our inertials, plus the inertials of other prudence organizations. In addition to that, it shows, or tries to show, the location of all of Hollis's sighs.
He systematically counted the Psi ident flags, which, one by one, had been removed from the map. He wound up holding the final one, that of S. Dole Melipone.
I know now where they are,
he said to Miss Wirt, who had lost her mechanical smile as she comprehended the significance of the unpositioned ident flags. Taking hold of her damp hand, he deposited Melipone's flag among her damp fingers and closed them around it.
You can stay here and meditate, he said. There's a vidphone over there,
he pointed.
No one'll bother you. I'll be in my office.
He left the map room, thinking,
I really don't know that this is where they are, all those missing sighs, but it's possible.
And Stanton Mick had waived the routine procedure of making an objective test. Therefore, if he wound up hiring inertials which he did not need, it would be his own fault. Legalistically speaking, Runciter Associates was required to notify the society that some of the missing sighs, if not all, had been found. But he had 5 days in which to file the notification, and he decided to wait until the last day.
This kind of business opportunity,
he reflected,
happens once in a lifetime. Mrs. Frick,
he said, entering her outer office.
Type up a work contract specifying 40.
He broke off. Across the room sat two persons. The man, Joe Chip, looked haggard and hungover and more than usually glum. Looked, in fact, about as always, the glumness accepted. But beside him lounged a long-legged girl with brilliant, tumbling black hair and eyes. Her intense, distilled beauty illuminated that part of the room, igniting it with heavy, sullen fire. It was, he thought, as if the girl resisted being attractive, disliked the smoothness of her skin and the sensual, swollen, dark quality of her lips.
She looks, he thought, as if she just now got out of bed, still disordered, resentful of the day, in fact of every day.
Walking over to the two of them, Runciter said,
I gather Gigi is back from Topeka.
This is Pat, Joe Chip said. No last name. He indicated Runciter, then sighed. He had a peculiar defeated quality hanging over him, and yet, underneath, he did not seem to have given up. A vague and ragged hint of vitality lurked behind the resignation. It seemed to Runciter that Joe most nearly could be accused of feigning spiritual downfall. The real article, however, was not there.
Anti-what?
Runciter asked the girl, who still sat sprawling in her chair, legs extended. The girl murmured,
Anti-ketogenesis.
What's that mean?
The prevention of ketosis.
The girl said remotely.
As by the administration of glucose.
To Joe, Runciter said,
Explain.
Give Mr. Runciter your test sheet, Joe said to the girl. Sitting up, the girl reached for her purse, rummaged, then produced one of Joe's wrinkled yellow score sheets, which she unfolded, glanced at, and passed to Runciter.
Amazing score, Runciter said. Is she really this good?
He asked Joe. And then he saw the two underlined crosses, the graphic symbol of indictment, of, in fact, treachery.
She's the best so far, Joe said.
Come into my office,
Runciter said to the girl. He led the way, and behind them, the two of them followed. Fat Miss Wirt, all at once, breathless, her eyes rolling, appeared.
I phoned Mr. Howard, she informed Runciter. He has now given me my instructions.
She thereupon perceived Joe Chip and the girl named Pat. For an instant, she hesitated, then plunged on.
Mr. Howard would like the formal arrangements made right away, so we may go ahead now. I've already acquainted you with the urgency and the time factor.
She smiled her glassy, determined smile.
Do you two mind waiting?
She asked them.
My business with Mr. Runciter is of a priority nature.
Glancing at her, Pat laughed, a low, throaty laugh of contempt.
You'll have to wait, Miss Wirt, Runciter said.
He felt afraid. He looked at Pat, then at Joe, and his fear quickened.
Sit down, Miss Wirt,
he said to her, and indicated one of the outer office chairs. Miss Wirt said,
I can tell you exactly, Mr. Runciter, how many inertials we intend to take. Mr. Howard feels he can make an adequate determination of our needs, of our problem.
How many?
Runciter asked.
11,
Miss Wirt said.
We'll sign the contract in a little while, Runciter said, as soon as I'm free.
With his big, wide hand, he guided Joe and the girl into his inner office. He shut the door behind them and seated himself.
They'll never make it,
he said to Joe.
With 11, or 15, or 20, especially not with S. Dole Melipone involved on the other side.
He felt tired as well as afraid.
This is, as I assume, the potential trainee that Gigi scouted in Topeka, and you believe we should hire her? Both you and Gigi agree. Well, then we'll hire her, naturally. Maybe I'll turn her over to Mick, he said to himself. Make her one of the 11. Nobody has managed to tell me yet, he said. Which of the Psi talents she counters?
Mrs. Frick says you flew to Zurich, Joe said. What did Ella suggest?
More ads, Runciter said. On TV. Every hour.
Into his intercom, he said,
Mrs. Frick, draw up an agreement of employment between ourselves and a Jane Doe. Specify the starting salary that we and the union agreed on last December. Specify...
What is the starting salary?
The girl Pat asked, her voice suffused with sardonic suspicion of a cheap, childish sort. Runciter eyed her.
I don't even know what you can do.
It's pre-cog, Glenn, Joe Chip grated, but in a different way.
He did not elaborate. He seemed to have run down, like an old-time battery-powered watch.
Is she ready to go to work? Runciter asked Joe. Or is this one we have to train and work with and wait for? We've got almost 40 idle inertials and we're hiring another. Well, 40 less, I suppose, 11. 30 idle employees, all drawing full scale while they sit around with their thumbs in their noses. I don't know, Joe. I really don't. Maybe we ought to fire our scouts. Anyway, I think I found the rest of Hollis's size. I'll tell you about it later.
Into his intercom, he said,
specify that we can discharge this Jane Doe without notice, without severance pay or compensation of any kind. Nor is she eligible for the first 90 days for pension, health, or sick pay benefits.
To Pat, he said,
starting salary in all cases begins at 400 creds per month, figuring on 20 hours a week. And you'll have to join a union. The Mine, Mill, and Smelter Workers Union. They're the one that signed up all the Prudence Organization employees 3 years ago. I have no control over that.
I get more, Pat said, maintaining vidphone relays at the Topeka Kibitz. Your scout, Mr. Ashwood, said,
our scouts lie, Runciter said. And, in addition, we're not legally bound by anything they say. No Prudence Organization is.
The office door opened, and Mrs. Frick crept unsteadily in with the typed-out agreement.
Thank you, Mrs. Frick,
Runciter said, accepting the papers.
I have a 20-year-old wife in Cold Pack, he said to Joe and Pat. A beautiful woman who, when she talks to me, gets pushed out of the way by some weird kid named Jory. And then I'm talking to him, not her. Ella frozen in half-life and dimming out. And that battered crone for my secretary that I have to look at all day long.
He gazed at the girl Pat, with her black, strong hair and her sensual mouth. In him, he felt unhappy cravings arise, cloudy and pointless wants that led nowhere, that returned to him empty, as in the completion of a geometrically perfect circle.
I'll sign,
Pat said, and reached for the desk pen.